I would say rehumanize. We shouldn't have to humanize human because by default we are. But since we live in a time that we tend to dehumanize people, we need to make the proactive effort to actually humanize them. And there is no way you can have empathy for a group of people that you don't see as human. So no matter who you think you're fighting against or you're for, the other is still a human being.
Kleine Pause.
Begegnungen in der Teeküche. Hello.
Hi.
This is like a really unusual podcast episode, but I'm here in Tel Aviv with a very special, I would say, guest, because usually I'm not talking in English and I'm not doing these episodes in Tel Aviv, but this is a first. And as usual, I would love if you introduce yourself.
So, hi, my name is Morgan and I'm originally from France and I've been living in Tel Aviv for the past 15 years. I'm non-binary and my pronouns are they and them, although I guess today we're going to use mostly you. What I do, like I'm an artist. I'm also a tattoo artist. And on my free time, I'm also an activist. I've been a feminist activist and queer activist for the past 4 or 5 years. And since October 7, I put a strong focus against anti-Semitism.
I will explain a bit the background story about how we got together and why we are sitting here. So I think it was in March when you did the
Yes.
Maybe the interview was before, but you did an interview.
2 days before.
Yes, an interview for Z. Maybe most of our listeners, like, they know the format. And it was for the International Women's Day. They interviewed people, women from around the world, especially about violence against women. And you were one of the interviewees.
Correct.
Then they did a post on social media. Yeah, they put, I don't know, maybe like 7 slides. And
something like this.
Yes.
A couple of slides from different people in the world, like feminists.
Yes.
I was one of them.
Yes, you were one of them. And maybe you can explain a bit about what's happened, just so I won't say something wrong now. Maybe not the big picture, because we don't only want to talk about this, even if it's connected to a lot of things we want to talk about. But this is like how we get together and maybe this explains a bit the background.
Sure. So what happened, I was actually pretty happy because I was offered to be interviewed on about Israeli women and what happened on October 7. And it's not something that happened, unfortunately, often enough that we acknowledge and talk about what happened to women in Israel, everywhere else in the world. So we did a long interview and the interview went really fine. And I explained about all that happened here and how I start feminist activism here. And of course, I mentioned the specificities of Israel issue with sexism. So I mentioned things happening with religion and military making specific kind of patriarchal system. And what happened is, like, I spoke mostly about Israeli women here and the shock and the lack of response from feminists around the world. And what they took out of that, out of this almost 2 hours interview, was that I was criticizing the Israeli army. So I was really shocked and I realized how much what you're saying can be twisted, even if it's journalism is supposed to be neutral or at least honest.
This is like how we started talking, because I also saw it and my response to it was like, so why is it so hard to acknowledge that horrible, violent things against women and also not only against women, of course, happen around the world and everywhere, like simultaneously at the same time? Like, I always think about the quote from a book of a good friend, and he always says that there's enough grief for everyone. And like talking about memory culture in Germany. And I thought in this moment, like, okay, there's enough violence for everyone, because they put in their slides. And it's important to mention that it was only the social media post, but that they chose on purpose, like which quotes they're taking.
Exactly.
So, there was one slide also like with a quote from a Palestinian woman. And then there were women from other like crisis regions and from all kinds of situations.
Yeah, and also from Mexico.
Yes. And I think, yeah, we can also like,
yeah.
I can even at the link, so you can see it. They changed it afterwards. And, but like, this was just an example of what's happening if we're talking about like intersectional feminism. I guess we will also get like whatever this means, and maybe also what's happening to intersectional feminism, like maybe in the aftermath also of the 7th of October. But this was such a good example of how it's so hard to, we're not saying like how it's so hard, how everyone always trying to be intersectional and trying to give different kinds of perspectives. But this like went wrong in like a crazy way.
This was really one-sided, and it was, again, I really don't feel like this was the intent of the journalist that interviewed me. She apologized several times for what happened, but the way the post on Instagram, the way the slides were not only made, but also the order of the slide made mine really sound like I was saying something that I didn't. And there is really, like, I believe zero possibility that it was just a honest mistake. Like, it was, like, intentionally something that was done to make me say something bad against my country and against the Israeli army. Like, it was not genuine at all. It was, like, it was made on purpose. Like, it was really obvious. And this is why a lot of people actually reacted, and a lot of people who've been following my work that I do with a feminist collective here in Tel Aviv. So actually they realized that I was part of this collective, and they were surprised, to say the least, that someone part of this collective could talk like that about Israel. So they reached out, because of course, since it was in German, for me, it was not really clear what was happening at first. And then when I realized what happened, I was, of course, disappointed, and I felt also guilty toward my collective. And I felt like I was being used, and I really felt extremely bad. But what I really loved also, which was a good outcome out of that, it's like a lot of people, like German people, feminists, came together and helped with taking the post down, which happened later during the evening, and to replace it with a quote that was reflecting my interview in a better way. So there is something bad about it, and the damage was already done in one way. But on the other hand, it also shows to me that if we come together, if we really try to put the truth back, there is also like strength in the collective. And this is something I love about feminism. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I felt that since October 7, that feminists could come together for something positive.
Yes, it's a really nice take. And this is also why this is just a background story, because in this story there's lying like so much of the topics we are dealing with in feminism, like whoever this we is, like worldwide, and how a situation like we have now, which is so polarized, which is so difficult, where dialogue becomes like
impossible
in some ways, how it can still have a positive touch even if something happens, if we are reacting to it in the right way. And this is something like I was, when I read it, I was like, how can you take this quote out from someone? Because I didn't know your work before. I think I saw some, but not intentionally. And then I researched a bit, and I checked what you're doing, and I read I also read the interview. And especially in this kind of situation where people are so vulnerable, and where it's so hard to have also other realities like in your view all the time, that someone who's actually trying to do that, like on the same day you did, maybe you can explain a bit about what you're doing in your art also, but you made a post which was like really intersectional, like also mentioning Palestinian women, and you're not like denying realities. You're not like saying just because I am experiencing this kind of pain, or we are experiencing this kind of vulnerability right now, how can they use someone like you, which is like, it's always bad,
it's not me at all. I felt like after, like already, I felt like I was always involved, like from far, of course, because I live in Tel Aviv, but I always felt like I was, through social media, I was involved with other feminist group in, like we were like doing work to try to link our work with them, to make always certain that we knew what was going on for other women in the world. And after the betrayal that I felt like was really intense and painful after October 7, I felt like it was just, wow, another betrayal. Like I was interviewed, and really it was sold to me, this interview, with the idea that we want your voice about Israeli women, about their suffering, and about the lack of response in the world.
So it was really like exactly what I wanted to talk about. And out of everything, they twist my word and they turn it against me. And I felt like, how many betrayal can we endure? Like, how many times will my word be twisted to be used against me? So this was and the betrayal was extremely painful. I felt really, really bad. And like you mentioned, my work was always intersectional. Like this post that we did, because just a bit background of what I'm doing as an activist, I'm actually a street art activist, meaning that I put messages or about queer representation or queer rights or about women's rights or lately against anti-Semitism. I put that in the streets. This is my approach. And then I took picture of it and I put it on Instagram, but I do it everywhere I go. Like if I travel, I'm going to take some with me and I'm going to put Iceland, in France, in Greece. Like this is, I always do it with me. It's part of who I am. So for 8th of March, I did a huge, huge message and I just reminded all the feminists of the world, or the so-called feminists of the world, but the huge diversity we have here in Israel of women. And it's not just Jewish, Israeli and Muslim Palestinian. It's not true at all. Just as Israeli, we have Muslim Israeli, we have Jewish Israeli, we have Catholic or Christian Israeli. We also have here like trans Israeli women, we have queer Israeli women, and we have also Druze people, we have Bedouin, we have Circassian. Like I could go on. The list was really long, but like, and we also mentioned, of course, Palestinian from Gaza and the West Bank and the Israeli Arab citizen, which is a different topic that I think most people don't really understand the difference between Palestinian from West Bank, from Gaza, and the one who hold Israeli citizenship. But this is maybe a different topic. But I just wanted to remind everyone about the diversity here. And I try to be inclusive and intersectional and to put everyone in my fight. And they twist my word and make it sound like I'm this settler-minded colonial, like just validating what the army is doing, or the opposite, that I'm this tokenized Jewish person that's going to be used to criticize. See, even Jews are criticizing the Israeli army. Even Israeli person are criticizing the Israeli army and what they're doing to Palestinians. And I'm acknowledging that the army is not perfect and they're doing things that I'm not okay with. And personally, I am for a ceasefire, and everything that needs to be done to get the hostages back should be done, in my opinion. But this is my opinion. But they actually made it sound like I was hating on my country, which I love. And because I love it, I want the best for it, which include criticizing it, but it also include uplifting it.
It's always the thing about complexity. Like we talked about it a lot before, that in a situation where the polarization is so strong, we are losing that much of the complexity of the real situations. Like just like you described right now, it's so easy to see everything biased and to see like everything as two groups right now, which you are fighting against. And then especially it's something that made me, when I researched it, even sad, I would say, because it's just showing how hard it's becoming if we are like not really listening, or if we are taking things out of proportion, if we're taking things the way we want to read it. And that's something that like really made me think, okay, so maybe we can just talk about it also from an educational view, because what I'm usually doing is somehow political education, is somehow thinking about like
so important,
all these problems we are dealing with, all kinds of inequality, all kinds of discrimination, and how we are facing it, and how it reflects also on schools and on teenagers and kids, and how we can actually think about the utopian way we want to live. Like, I know it sounds big, but I'm not saying it from a idealistic view and thinking, okay, we just do this and this is the recipe. And then
I wish
yes, but this is where I'm coming from. It's like, we need to learn about the dynamics and we need to learn about how these things happen in the media. And yes, I'm not saying like all the media is wrong and stuff like this, but your example
it's
is
a general trend.
Yes, it's such a good example of how things shift, even if you're trying, and how hard it became, and maybe especially now. So I think it's because usually we are connecting the topic and the guest to schools and somehow or I connect it. I would also ask you the question, and maybe we, through this we get like a bit your background and what you're doing. Like if you think about education and about the things that I just mentioned in some way and your work, what comes to your mind?
So no, I actually feel like my work is both political and educational. I always saw my work as something educational. Why putting it in the street is so important to me, because I could just write on my Instagram the same sentences I'm putting in the street without all the work that I have to prepare and then to go in the street and actually put it there and sometimes being aggressed or harassed for that, or people not being too happy about me doing it. But why it's so important, it's because I start thinking about this process a few years ago, because most of my, I would say, feminist awakening and queer activist awakening came from other group I've been following online, mostly Instagram. So I was like, wow, Instagram and social media are such a great source for knowledge. Like so many things I didn't know and I didn't have not only access to, but I didn't even think of looking for, came to me and it was amazing. But then I start thinking, okay, the more I look into a topic, the more the algorithm is going to feed me this topic. But what about things I never thought even would exist, or I wouldn't even know what to look for them? So I thought to put things in the street, which might sound a bit aggressive, but it was like putting it in people's face. Like they don't have to look for it to find it, to read it. It's like it's here. And maybe they would have never thought about a specific issue, but to see suddenly they're going for a walk, to walk their dog, to walk, or I don't know, to buy grocery shopping, and suddenly they see a message. And maybe it's, most people won't react to it, but maybe someone will say, wow, I never thought about that, but now I want to know more about it. And in this regard, I think it's really educational, because I want to take it out of Instagram by using kind of the same approach. Like it's short messages that will catch your attention, but will make you want to know more about the topic. This was really something. Also to give visibility about topic that sometimes people don't want to see, or the media, since we're talking about the media. Media, or as much as they try to be, or some might want to be, they're nothing but neutral. There is no such thing as being really neutral or fully objective in storytelling or anything, even if you think it's the truth. So I feel like often media have their own choice of what they want to show, for whatever reason, because it's in line with their political idea or opinion, or because it will bring more clicks and more money for advertisement. I don't know. They have their own reason. So I want to put things in the street that maybe the mainstream media will not show, but that way I actually bring it to a large public, because public space, especially in big city, got a lot of people going back and forth. So this was something to actually balance that. And I mean, it's not at the same scale because I'm just me, but it does work and it does trigger conversation. And even one conversation that it helped, or one person that it helped, someone, I've been contacted several times by even queer people because I put message like queer visibility matter, or I put with like some flags or anything, and people will write me messages on Instagram and say, wow, you know, I went out of my house this morning and I saw this and I felt seen in a way that I never feel seen in usual, regular mainstream media. So for me, every one person that can help like that is a victory. You know, it feel like it helps people feel better with themselves, and it gives people the urge to learn about a topic. So I do believe it's both political and extremely educational.
And you already mentioned that your focus after the 7th of October shifted a bit. I think I want to come back to this later and for the reasons of it. So maybe just so the listeners like understand a bit more where you're like coming from. Exactly. You're also part of a feminist collective that you also mentioned in the interview. So maybe you can explain a bit also about this background story.
Sure. So actually, originally, I started doing street art activism with my collective, which was, let's say, a copy-paste kind of a feminist group that's called Collage in France. And we were really in touch with them, and they explained us how to start and to implement it here in Israel, because it's a really effective way of putting things in the street once again. And the focus when we started was specifically feminism. So we wanted to talk about, of course, feminism in other countries. It was important for us to be part of what we thought by then when we were idealistic. Was like a global feminist movement of liberation for women and all kind of minority that needed. And we decided to put still the main focus on Israeli society because we have our own way of having systemic issues here, including, say, sexism. And our society, Israeli society, is different than like any country. We have our unique set of the way patriarchy and sexism is expressed. So we wanted to address it specifically. We also wanted to address it in Hebrew. But it was also important for us, since it's a country where a lot of people come from a lot of places in the world, not just tourists, but to live here, we started this collective as an open collective, I would say, meaning that there were the core that was me and a few friends that were always doing it, and people could contact us and come one time to put things in the street with us, or two times, whatever. So this is why we call open collective. And you could write in any language that you want. Like, you're comfortable in English, you could write in English. You want to write something in Spanish because it's your mother tongue, you can do it. We had people putting messages in Arabic, in Russian, in like all kind of different languages. And also because when you walk in the street, if you want message to catch your eye, if it's your mother tongue, it will always catch your eyes more. And because it's a multicultural, multi-language society, it was really the point. So this is how I started doing this in the streets. And this collective was also one of the reasons I was contacted for the interview that created all these issues eventually, because I was contacted as part of being a collective that's doing feminist work to talk about Israeli women. And also because personally, on the side, since October 7, like we mentioned, my work shifts a bit from having strong focus on feminism and queer rights to anti-Semitism. Because I was really shocked about the world's reaction or lack of reaction toward what happened here, which was either it didn't happen or if it did happen, you deserved it anyway. So like half feminists that for years have been saying no victim deserved it ever. No victim should be asked to prove that it happened. By default, we believe women. Suddenly it was like Israeli or lying. Israeli women are just making it up. So I cannot even explain the scale, like the shock that I found myself in. So my focus shifted on fighting against anti-Semitism at this point. And so this is again why I was interviewed, because it was at the intersection of anti-Semitism and feminism and how Jewish women specifically, not just Israeli, over the past decades have been feeling a different type of sexism. Because in general, like the anti-Semitic trope are like, Jews are liars, or they're trying to control, or they like to manipulate, or they deserve what happened to them. And suddenly, because it's Jewish women, we don't believe them because Jews, and including Jewish women, are manipulative, and they're lying, they're making it up, or they deserve it. So it was really like the intersection of this both issue that was supposed to be the core of the interview, and why people didn't really believe Israeli women, or didn't care about Israeli women. So imagine my shock when I opened the post on Instagram. So again, like it was it's really important work for me. And I was really hoping someone will amplify my voice for once, and abroad it was even better. So yes, the reaction of the media, how they decide to present some work, even if you answer an interview as genuinely as you can with all your honesty and the media decide eventually how they want to present it. No matter what you can say, they will decide what they want to make out of it. So I think this is something that we need to learn about. It's like how to handle what media are giving us.
We just talked a bit also before we started recording. And also the fact to accept that your focus can shift in a vulnerable situation like this, or in like a situation where you maybe experienced, I wouldn't say for the first time, but in like this dramatic scale, this intersection so clearly, like even if all the things you just mentioned would not, okay, they are thrown at people, said like this, but also you can see it in a structural way, how the response to this and the not believing Israeli woman and the not talking about sexual violence and all of these things in the aftermath of the 7th of October really came to the surface, how this created a fully like new sort, new way of discrimination. Yeah. And this is what intersectionality does, like to say, like, okay, this, there are intersections and they create a new type. It's not just do you are experiencing as a queer person, some kind of discrimination or as a woman, but the combination creates something new. And I think it's so crazy to think or to criticize you as a person after something like this happens, that you are trying to call this out and you are saying, okay, this is my focus right now because this is my experiences. And at the same time, we said it before, you are not denying that there's other realities which are as horrible or as painful as yours.
That should be, yes, called out, exactly. So yes, this is exactly that. It's like what I've been doing lately, like we mentioned, it's like my focus has been mostly on fighting against antisemitism, because even though I've been living in Israel for more than a decade, I still grew up in France. So I grew up like as a minority as being Jewish. So I was really shocked by the scale of the antisemitism, and not only that, but how fast, like, I felt like it has risen in like overnight. It's like suddenly so many people were openly saying that Jews are bad, or they would say Zionists are bad, but it's like, it's never Zionist. Like, again, you're allowed to criticize the Israeli government. I know I do. Okay. But it's like criticizing a country and denying a country's right to exist are two different things. And when people are said like they're anti-Zionist and they criticize Jews under the cover of saying we're criticizing only Zionists, what they're saying is like, Jews don't have the right to have a country. They don't have the right, like this country doesn't have the right to exist, which is not the same thing. And of course, Palestinians also have a right to have a country. I'm not saying that, but I've been talking a lot about, as a person who suffers from antisemitism, I decided like I want to talk about that. So I'm not denying what's happening to Palestinians, and actually I'm also vocal about it. But it's true that my main focus is on what I'm myself experiencing and what my children might experience. And since I've been doing that, people are coming to me throwing weird assumptions at me that because I speak against antisemitism, it automatically means that I don't care about what's happening in Gaza. I'm supporting for sure my government. Like, I want as many deaths as possible, because the worst thing was still that we are weaponizing what happened on October 7th, like as an excuse. So we allowed now to create damage on a civilian population in Gaza, which is like nothing could be further from the truth. They are the one weaponizing it, saying we are not allowed to talk about our own pain. We are not allowed to center our own pain, because if we do, automatically we're bad person, because Jews are supposed to be manipulative. So we're using it only to manipulate people into giving us, okay, you know what? You can go and kill people there. Which, like, it's not, we just want people to acknowledge what we've been through. It was just so horrible what happened that day. It was so horrifying that even a month after the fact, it was still hard to identify some bodies. And I mean, it's not the same, but I've been visiting some of the kibbutz where it happened afterward, and just to see it. And it was 2 months, 3 months after I've been there, just to see how it looked like, how it was. And I was like visiting with a friend of my husband that lived there and experienced that firsthand. And thank God he and his family are fine, but he lost a lot of people that day. And to have him recount me the story, he even made me listen to some of the messages that were sent on the WhatsApp group of the kibbutz that day. Like, I felt like I left that place. It took me days to recover. The scale of the pain and the horror is unimaginable. And the whole world is saying like, we're making it up, or we're just, we deserve it, or we're just using it as an excuse not to, or worse, Israeli did it to their own so they could just have an excuse. The same way that we heard all our life in Israel that, of course, Jews create the Holocaust so they could have an excuse to create Israel. Like, it's exactly the same. It's like the antisemitism is morphing, but at its core, it's saying the same. Like, in the Middle Ages, it was religious antisemitism. We killed Jesus, so we deserve to die. And then it became a race issue. Our race is inferior, so we're polluting a good race, so we deserve to die. Or culturally, we're bringing down any civilization, so we deserve to die. And now we're horrible people who give excuses to kill and kill our own people once again for whatever excuse. So we deserve to die. It's like, it's just, it's morphing, but it's staying the same. And I think why people fail to identify antisemitism inside people who usually fight against discrimination, it's like, antisemitism is a different type of racism than other racism. Of course, every type of racism got its own specificities. And I'm not saying that we're better because we always hear that Jews are privileged, even in there, because we want our own discrimination to be put aside. But it's because it is a different type. Where most racism are like, these people are less than us. They're worse less than us. They're like the scum of earth, or they're like, we are the opposite. It's like people will say, we're the one who are controlling. We are more rich. We think we are better. We think we got more. So we experience something like people think we're privileged. While other groups who are discriminated against, they're made feel like they have less. We are described as someone who have more. So we should be taken down for that. Because of course, if we have power, which, well, we don't have more than anyone else. If we have power, of course, we're going to use it for nefarious ideas. We're going to use it to manipulate or control. So this is more insidious type of racism because everyone thinks it's a privilege that we're rich, that whatever. So people don't want to fight it, even against racism, you know, like people who fight racism or any type of discrimination. Antisemitism was always left aside. No one is mentioning it because we're white. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're privileged. We're not like, I don't know, we were killed because we were not white and suddenly we're white. So, sorry, I was really long on that.
But it's important.
It's such an important topic for me, and I can talk for like the next 3 days.
No, I really think it because I'm doing this work for quite a while already. And I'm like, also in this podcast, we are like from time to time focusing on like things at the same time. And sometimes we are like picking really one type of discrimination and focus on this to explain more. And it's something that I'm talking also a lot with friends and with colleagues about, that it's so important to really educate yourself about the things you just explained and about how different types of discrimination work differently. And I think this is one of the most important things to acknowledge, that the narrative of it or the imagination, because it's always, because it's always an imagination. Like we all know that the world itself is more complex and discrimination is making it more easy. Antisemitism like is always something where you kick up. And in like racism and other kinds of discrimination, you supposedly kick down, but because you imagine like you dehumanize in different ways. Like, and this is like something so important. And it's just like a short explanation now. Like you can read about it. We can't cover like this whole thing right now, but if you don't understand these mechanisms and if you don't choose to educate yourself about these mechanisms and dynamics and also differences, even if the results are, I don't want to say like the same, because it can also like lead to different kinds of violence in the end. But of course, it doesn't matter, like whoever experienced violence because of discrimination, like it's horrible. Like this is something you can state. Like it's not like, okay, just because the dynamics are different, the violence is like
it's
worse.
Yes.
So of course that, but at the same time, like this is something that I also realized throughout the work I'm doing. You have this daily life discrimination, which you fight in like every way, but the underlining knowledge about it is so important to fight things in the long run. And this is something I'm all the time like really missing. And so I'm happy that you explained it, even if you just can explain it a little bit here, because it's like really, really a thing that also like, when we are coming back to what you said before, also, if you're talking about a feminist intersectional view, it's so easy to just say it. It's so easy to say, okay, I'm a feminist, but I'm like intersectional feminist. I'm progressive. I'm this and this and this. But if I don't know what happens in these combinations and that they work differently, that it's like not the same if you are experiencing, and I think every person who is experiencing different types of racism would agree, like it's not the same if you say, okay, my intersection here and like explaining this situation or this kind of discrimination is like sexism and let's say anti-black racism. It creates its own form. Yes. And also what you explained before, anti-Semitism and sexism creates its own form. And it's so important to go like behind the surface of this and to really see the complexity and not deny it, that it's like, it's different. It's not all the same.
To acknowledge it is not, again, justifying anything. I mean, when you believe any woman, like when Me Too started and it took like huge proportion, it's like, there were no women that just, you know, took to the street and said death to all men. It's like, but in case of Israeli, they saw that acknowledging what happened to us, because some, I know, like in France, for instance, because I'm also following French news, obviously, I know that some feminists say, yes, of course, probably it happened, or yes, of course it happened, but, and it was always a but, it's not an excuse to suddenly go and kill, or like, if we actually acknowledge that it happened, it's like we're validating the fact that they can go and kill, which, when believing women become an excuse to go and hunt or kill someone, like, this is never what we ask, but suddenly in our case, people are projecting behavior on us, which are the result of anti-Semitism, because they expect the worst from Jews. Mm-hmm. So acknowledging that maybe some wrong was done to us, it would be like acknowledging that we have right to respond to it, but we're going to respond in the worst way possible, because this is what we always do. Mm-hmm. The same way that we're willing to apparently sacrifice so many of our own population just for an excuse to go kill people in Gaza. So yes, the specificities of anti-Semitism is at play here, and not just Israel. This is why it's not anti-Zionism, it's anti-Semitism. I also think that most of the world is not interested in knowing that a lot of people in Israel with Israeli citizenship are not Jewish, which I think most people are missing everywhere else, that they have no idea that 2 million of Israeli citizens with same right and holding a passport are actually from Palestinian descent. They call themselves either Arab Israeli or Palestinian Israeli. This sometimes depends on the people, and everyone can identify the way they prefer, of course. But there, 2 million of them actually have Israeli citizenship, and some were killed on October 7, a lot of Bedouin family were affected and lost people in horrible ways as well on October 7. Like, no one is acknowledging that it's not just Jews. So even if you are against Jews, let's say, which is not okay at all, of course, but how about people who are not Jewish, but are also Israeli, who are also killed during that day? How about all the tourists? How about the foreign workers? Like, no one is acknowledging that, because it's easier, like you say, to put things in black and white, because it's an easy filter to understand the world, or to think we understand the world. So it's like all Jews or Israeli are the same. So even Jews abroad now are as accountable as Israelis for what the Israeli government is doing, because we're all the same anyway. And then we can all be against them, because we feel, I mean, we say we, but of course not me. A lot of people, I think, feel empowered now that they have a cause and that they can just go and experience justified violence against a specific group of people. It's like all these groups that are advocating for social justice and for peace, and there is always a violent undercurrent there. You know, like when we say fuck the system, or eat the rich, or things like that, like it's all in good fun and joke, but you can always feel that there is an undercurrent of people seeing, like, people with privilege, they should be taken down, you know, a peg or two. Like, so this undercurrent of violence found its scapegoat, which is once again the Jews. And it's not, I'm not saying that in a way we're more privileged, like why I'm trying to put ourselves aside. It's just like, again, it's something that's systemic and that's coming back every several decades. And we see similar things. It's just like, instead of anti-Semitism, it's anti-Zionism. It's like what Israel is doing. But so we need to educate ourselves about that. And I'm saying everyone should. And even myself as a Jewish person, I'm learning so many things about the internalized anti-Semitism that I grew up with, and I was not aware until a few years ago. And I think October 7 opened my eyes on how much more I had even to learn myself about how anti-Semitism is manifesting. So someone who is not even Jewish, for sure everyone is anti-Semitic, the same way that everyone is a bit racist. Like, not actively, I don't think we're aware of that, but we all have, me included, our own bias against women, against such or such minority. We all have that. And acknowledging that
even though it's painful to say it, it was really painful to me to realize that I had anti-Semitic bias myself, that I had sexist bias myself, that I had racist bias myself. It was extremely painful. But if you don't do this first step, you cannot learn. And to realize that you're doing it against your own community, it's a bit easier. I mean, it hurts in a different way, but it's easier because it helps you realize, like, okay, if I was doing against myself and it's me, as for sure I'm doing it against other people, it's becoming easier to accept. But we need to realize what's happening inside ourselves, and it's a painful journey and it's taking a long time. But if we want to make change, we cannot expect society to change if we're not able to even identify within ourselves where it went wrong and how our education affected us. Like, I thought there is no anti-Semitism in France all my life. Yet, all my life I heard, don't go out with a star around your neck, or don't say you're Jewish. And I was thinking there is no anti-Semitism, and at the same time I was accepting this truth, and I was never questioning it, you know? So it's like, this is why I say we all have those bias.
Sometimes as a woman, like, the way to realize it is thinking about your internal misogyny and your internal sexism. But maybe it's like a personal take on it, because you in your head think yourself, like, you grew up with it and it's so internal in this bias of men and women, and you need to unlearn this first and gender equality and stuff like this. But I experience for myself, like, so many times sexist tropes that I am using on other women, and it's taking me, like, so much time to first learn to see it and then to react accordingly and to say, like, no, I'm not going to do this anymore. Like, I'm not going to react even in my thinking in this way anymore, because I know that it's sexist, but it's really hard, not to do it. And even if you're yourself a woman and you would not want other people to, like, see you in this way, just what you described, it really helped me to have this aha moment of realizing, okay, so if I am, like, sexist and I am a woman, why shouldn't I be racist? Even if I don't want it, of course. No one wants it. Like, no, I think no person would say, like, okay, maybe some, okay.
Some people are okay with that, but the majority of people,
like, yeah. And this is why education about this is, like, just as you described, it's so important, but in a taking it serious way, not just in a, okay, we just want equal rights for everyone, and it's, like, so easy to say it and to spread it out.
And then what?
Exactly. Like, it's really like a hard journey. And it's very important to think about how you can do it. And you're choosing one way of saying, like, okay, I give it, like, more awareness, and especially in a vulnerable situation where it comes to place in, like, this obvious way. Now it's maybe opening a window in some way to focus more on that, because this is, like, happening right now. But with the background knowledge that you have, because you decided to go on this journey and to do it to yourself and, like, probably also to people around you, with this knowledge of, even if I'm going back, or even if I'm, like, going there, like, to focus on this right now, I am doing it with the awareness of all these other kinds of discrimination. And and you always have to play this, like, I it sounds, like, not serious enough, but let's say, like, mind games with yourself. I all the time, like, when I'm watching the news and people are talking about Israelis and Palestinians, I always have to, like, really shake my head and say, okay, this is not the picture that comes up in my head, is not the real picture. Yes. Like, because there is a lot of the diversity you mentioned is not the first thing that comes also to my head. But as soon as I learned about it, I can, like, decode my thinkings and I can work with it, and it doesn't make it better, it doesn't solve everything, but it's, like, a start. And that's something which is, like, I think, so important. And this is also why I think it's, like, it's also not the solution, like, we're not talking solutions at all, but this is
the problem is the first step in the direction.
And the messages in the street can do that. They can start to make you think, like, okay, I never thought about that, or I know it, but I stopped thinking about that. And especially in, like, these polarized times where the pressure is so high to always be on the supposedly one side or other side, and
on the good side.
This is the thing
I hear often. But I'm just going to go back to second to what you say, that you say maybe was a bit childish, but actually I love it, the idea of a mind game, because like we're discussing, of course, like education and pedagogy. And I am a firm believer that you learn more when you're actually having fun and through play. I mean, we see also with children, but I think even as adults. So actually to see it in a playful way, because it's such a serious topic, it can be a bit overwhelming and scary to even start it. Mm-hmm. And I think to approach it in, you know, like when you play those game or like a board game, when you need to gather clues and try to see the bigger picture, like whatever, if you need to find who killed who or who did what. So I think to approach it in this way that is a bit more light, okay, that's at least less heavy. I think it's the correct way to do it. Maybe not for everyone, but I think for most of us, if we were actually approach it that way, maybe it's like less scary. You know, it's like we can play detective and try to find clues here and there. So actually it was just something on the side. I would say I actually love this idea of a mind game. I think it's perfect. And also to go back on when you say reading news about either Israel or Palestine that are against, always so polarized, and a lot of people are falling victim of propaganda, because there is also a lot of propaganda on all sides coming from everywhere. And I know that myself, I make a point, even if it's also sometimes painful, to read news that I disagree with, or to follow people, or maybe I won't follow them on Instagram, but I will go to their page once in a while and see what they're saying, because I need to question what I'm getting. And if I only read things that go and further my own opinion, so it's feeding my bias already that I have about the way I see the world, as how can I know that it's not my bias, but it's reality? So of course, several truths can happen at the same time. So first of all, it's important to acknowledge them. And how can you do it if you don't even know that several of them exist at the same time? And also, again, like we have this natural bias as human being to want to read and hear about things that comfort us in our own opinion. So to make the effort to try to find news, of not saying to go weird thing that's going to be like, you can see it's like it's too much. And when it's too much in one direction, usually there is a chance it's propaganda. But to make the effort sometimes to read news or to hear people that you wouldn't agree with, even though it's annoying and sometimes you want to a bit slap them. But it's just like, it happened once in a while that you read something and you're like, ah, I never thought about that. But you know what? It's kind of making sense to me. I want to explore that a bit further. And maybe at the end you will say, no, I'm going to stay with my opinion. But maybe you will see the world differently, and maybe it will allow you to, I would say, rehumanize. We shouldn't have to humanize human, because by default we are. But since we live in a time that we tend to dehumanize people, we need to make the proactive effort to actually humanize them. And there is no way you can have empathy for a group of people that you don't see as human. So I, no matter who you think you're fighting against or you're for, the other is still a human being. So, and there is always victims. It's like when I hear about, of course, I hate Hamas with a passion, and I don't believe everyone is innocent in Gaza, but I also don't believe that everyone is guilty either. And when I see photos of people, like of children starving, and it's happening 70 kilometers away from me, what happened on 7th of October, it won't bring them back to do this. I mean, I want the hostage back, and we need to find a way to do it, but starving children to death is not going to bring anyone back. And it's actually, we don't want people to dehumanize us, but it's taking our own humanity away on our own to do that, or to think like it's okay to do that. So we always need to be careful what we do to other and what we do to our own humanity in the process, I think. And again, because it's so heavy, I think to approach it, like you mentioned, like in kind of a fun way, is making it more approachable. Like exactly like I do with my children. My oldest is 7, like almost 8. And since we're starting to look things on Google sometimes when he asks questions, and I honestly tell him when I have no idea. Like when he was smaller, I used to Google it on the side and then pretend like, I know. Now I'm telling him, you know what? I don't know. Let's look for a way to find the answer together. So I'm not just opening Google. I'm trying to teach him little by little. Let's see if we find a different answer. Okay, and then we're going to gather like all the clues that we found, and we're going to try to understand what's the proper answer out of all of that. So I think since I've been doing that with him, I really feel like it's a nice approach to always check what you're reading. When you read a quote, you know that most of the time it's going to be taken out of context, or maybe it was cut in half and it means something completely different. So to make the effort before you share anything, at least let's not be part of the problem. Share the quote after you read the whole article or you watch the video. And then if you still agree with it, then I think it's okay. But to share without checking, it's just like, okay, it's like you're becoming part of the issue. So, and it doesn't take that much effort to watch a 2-minute video before you're sharing a quote. If that quote is so important for you to share, you can take the 2 minutes of your time to actually read the full thing.
100%. And I hope this also happened even beside the quote they took from you with your article back then. And at the same time, I'm always thinking like everything you're saying and all these interviews and all like the media and journalism around is like, it's so important, and it's so important to have the skills to like deal with it. And we were talking about like humanizing and dehumanizing, and in an educational way, I always think still, like, even if you have all these perspectives and you can get it, and even if it's bothering you and you have to go through it, I sometimes think like, okay, but still, how do we go back to these basics? How can we still make sure that the dialogue is happening? And even now, like we said, we are not on like different poles of some political views or whatever, but I'm always think you can learn so much from just being with people and being together, and all these situations, they take this away like crazy.
Yes.
And this is also because, okay, people in Germany who are listening to the podcast, they know the work of friends that I also told you about who are like going to school. One is Israeli and German, and one is Palestinian German, and they doing like a trialogue, not only a dialogue, like with the students, and they're letting them ask, and they say, okay, this is a room where the first of all, that you can ask your questions, even if you're not sure if it's politically correct or whatsoever. It's a safe, at least they try, because they also say, okay, but maybe some things which are said here will hurt other people who are in this room, but we are trying to make this work. And this is something that, beside all of this knowledge you can gather and how I approach these things, like, and stay sane in, like, even if it's a really hard thing to do in all this by myself when I'm on social media, I always think, okay, how can we create more of these really human conversations and dialogue, because it's so important? What are your thoughts on this? Or do you say, like, right now, it's just impossible to do
I really don't think it's impossible. Sorry. I know that the way I do it, but I wish I had a perfect answer for that. The way I'm doing it, it's like, I know those voices, they do exist already. Mm-hmm. They are, like you mentioned, like, people who come together and, mm-hmm. sometimes they try to solve things. They try to offer solution, at least like on a small scale. And sometimes it's just to share like their own history and to hear and to be acknowledged also by the other side. But those voices, they exist. There is a lot of, maybe not enough, but there are lots. I know in Israel, there are a lot of groups that are advocating for peace, or at least to know and to learn about the other, to learn to live together. Like, we don't have to be friend all the time, but we can be good neighbor kind of thing, you know? So it's not about just like over optimist, like we can all suddenly share a meal and everything, but at least to learn to live together, which is, in my opinion, more realistic goal to reach, to become good neighbors and to become best friends. So, but those groups, they exist. It's just like, their voice are not amplified. Like you say, it's polarized and people choose, and a lot of media, but also like, I'm not talking only about newspaper, but also like, let's say influencer, people who have a huge following, like individual, who have a huge following. Yes. And especially for a younger generation, they have a huge following. And those people, I don't know if it's like, probably they also have their own opinion and they're also victim of all of that, but they share things that are antagonizing us more and more. And there are so many people here, at least I know here, because I don't know otherwise, but in Israel, I know because a lot of my friends are working in this or peace activists and so on. So I know about all those things that are happening. And these are the voices that we need to amplify. People that want to live together, but not just as
a foreign idea, like we just say like that, but are really putting the work to do it. And there are a lot of podcasts, there are more and more podcasts that are often in English because Israelis also realize and Palestinians that we need outside help for that. Mm-hmm. We need those kind of voices to be amplified. So you can decide to actually look for those kind of voice and help them being amplified because they're the one that are not shared and they're the one that actually, if a solution, a peaceful solution might come one day, it's through those kind of people that it will come. And they're being shut down everywhere. Like, I don't think Hamas is really happy to share those kind of people, like, voices. Like, I know a friend of my sister that from Gaza, because she met him during her peace activist work, as he's currently living already for a few years in Belgium because as a peace activist, he was threatened by Hamas and had to flee. So they're not letting, but the Israeli government is not really, I would say, happy when you have Israeli voicing things loudly against them. Mm-hmm. So it's not really encouraged. Like they always threaten to cut down funds for this type of organization. A lot of time they rely on international funding to be able to work. So for people to know they exist and to give those voice power by relying them and giving money for their work to continue, you can help by sharing. Okay. I think this is the most important. Just give those voice as much power as you can because they're being drawn into all the noise that we have. So this is the thing. Those voice exist. We just need to help and just make them heard. I really think it's the best way because even like, for instance, there is this podcast that's called The Third Narrative that is made by two Palestinian Israeli person that they're hosting it and they speak in English on purpose. So it's like a international reach and they have this good point. Like I don't know how they live. I mean, I know one of her, of these two, but they have this unique perspective to know the Palestinian society and the Israeli society because they grew up as Palestinian holding Israeli citizenship and living in Israel. So they know also, they speak Hebrew and they know all the Israeli system and they also know all the struggle that Palestinians are facing. So, and they also acknowledge the right of both to live because they say it's both part of their identity today. So they have such a complex identity and they have such a different perspective on all the things that are happening and how maybe we could live together because they've been doing it their whole life. So this is really the type of voice I think more than Israeli Jews even, or Palestinian maybe from the West Bank and Gaza, those type that are a mix of both worlds. If one day we find a solution, I personally believe that it might come from them.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about this, check what you're thinking. Like you can easily say, like even in our conversation now, how many of these voices you heard in the in the last months. Like if everyone who's listening to our conversation right now just goes back to which voices are you hearing? And did you ever saw, like, I don't know, like even, I don't know, minorities from here speaking about this? Like, I can also understand that they are already like vulnerable in their identity, but some do, yes. And this is like also something, even I, like where I have a lot of like views on this and connections and stuff like this, but even I can easily say it's not easy, like from like a German view. Mm-hmm. To hear these voices and
even
to find
them.
You need to search for it actively.
And because I have, again, like I have a lot of friends and family who work in peace activism in Israel. So it was kind of easy for me to find them because it's people I know. So the connection was made easily. But most people I know here, they don't even know about those voices and they do live in Israel. And not only that, they live in Tel Aviv, which is supposed to be a kind of bubble type that a bit more like, I don't want to use the word progressive anymore because, but they said they should be more aware of those type of voices and even they are not. So we were asking earlier how I try to amplify those voices or how I do my part in that. So of course I share in my Instagram, but because I do things also in the street and I do believe Israeli don't know about those voices, I started doing lately collaboration, which was not just online, but actually when I see some thing that's nicely written, or I hear a podcast and I think like, okay, this doesn't get the attention it needs. And I think it's important as I offer to actually, I ask them if it's okay that I write part of what they say and I'm going to put it in the street. And of course, I'm going to also put their name, not just mine. And then I'm going to also share when I post on my Instagram, I will
also do as a collab with them. So yeah. I share. So this is the way so far that I found that help amplify those voices, both online and in the real world, because I cannot blame the world for not knowing about those voices. Even the majority of Israeli don't know, you know? So yes, for me, it starts here, but I know that most of my reach on Instagram is mostly abroad, like maybe 60%, 70% of people who are following me are abroad. So it's also important for me that I share, because I know that, again, those podcasts or those work are done in English, they can be shared more easily. So,
yes, it's really nice. So usually I would ask you now for homework and I will do it. But maybe I can say myself also that through you, like, of course, we can also like add some more things where you say, okay, it's really worth it to follow them. And also, like, of course, like, what you can do, it's just logic from what you just said, is like following you and then you share stuff in your stories and you do the collaborations and blah, blah. So this is what I would say, because probably your homework will not be just follow me and that's it.
It would not be that.
A lot of things you said or a lot of things we can talk about there. For sure, just impulses on like thinking when we are talking, because all of these topics, they are complex. It is big. It's not so easy to share and dig deep and all the knowledge about it. Like, it's really like people have to do the work also. That's just what it is.
Let's be honest. It's a lot of work and we cannot become knowledgeable into every single topic that's make the news. But like, there is one thing, like for me, like if you talk about homework and all, like first, like in the educational approach, I think, and you already know that probably, but it's important, I think, to remind students that the point of school should be to teach them how to think and not what to think, to really like learn to question everything. And I know a lot of people don't like also in the educational system, I had a lot of teachers that didn't like that I was questioning things, but I think to teach people that we're teaching you how to think, not what to think. And it's the same for the media. They're telling you what to think and you should always like think, okay, how I want to take that. So this was the main thing I think you should do. And the second thing, if it's a concrete homework, like you can do more easily. I will send you the link if you want to add it. Like, so the third narrative podcast, because really out of all the things I followed, I really love this one. They're really talking good and it's really pedagogic and open and easy to follow. So maybe listen to one episode of this podcast. Let's start with one. Mm-hmm. So it's easy homework. And then like even listen it with friends and discuss it together. Just what did you think about that? Did you know about this type of voice? Like how it made you feel to read? So this is the homework, I think. Listen to one episode of this podcast, possible with other people, and discuss it after.
It's a really nice homework. Thank you very much. And I can also only say thank you. Like, I'm really happy that we are having time to do it and that you took the time to do it. And I saw a lot of your work in the streets already. I took a lot of pictures. So I can really only recommend also to use the things you're putting, which you can also see on Instagram. Like it's shorter. It's not the whole podcast episode, but it can also give you this impulse of thinking about what you wrote there and why it's important to give it like maybe a few minutes and not just.
Thank you. Yeah, for me, it's always more important to use actually my reach to, like I said, to amplify other voices that I think are more relevant at the moment, but you're always welcome to to follow me. And thank you really for actually amplifying my voice by doing this this episode. So I'm really thanking you.
And thanks everyone for listening. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.